Hey, comic book fans, this is Mark Hamill. You're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Greetings, salutations, and a super welcome one and all to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. And if you're looking for cool conversations with the talented folks who bring comic book characters to life on the big screen, small screen, animation, video games, live shows, all over the place, then you have come to the right place. It is Flashback, Flash Forward February here on Comic Book Central, my month-long celebration of the world of DC Comics' Scarlet Speedster. The month might be winding down, but we are definitely ramping up at lightning speed with one amazing guest after another here in the lair. From the current CW show, I have welcomed hero and villain Kid Flash and Zoom, Keenan Lonsdale and Teddy Sears. They were both here. From the new DC animated series Justice League Action, the Flash himself, Charlie Schlatter. He slowed down long enough to visit the lair. Today, kids, we are touching all the bases here in Comic Book Central. My special guest today, he appeared on the original Flash series back in 1990, as well as the new Flash series as the Trickster. He's also on Justice League Action with Charlie Schlatter, reprising his role as the Joker. 25 years he's been bringing the evil as the Joker. In his spare time, he's also the savior of a galaxy far, far away. The one, the only, Mark Hamill will be along in just a few minutes to talk all about those characters, his new pop culture series on Comic-Con HQ, and much, much more. This is going to be a fun one today. Also this month, I'm giving each and every one of you listeners out there a shot at season one of The Flash on Blu-ray. Absolutely free. Man, what more could you ask for? It's thanks to the fine folks at Warner Brothers. This is the season where Mark Hamill returned as the Trickster. He reunited with John Wesley Shipp, the original Flash from the CBS series. That episode is on there, The Tricksters. There's also a special feature on the Blu-ray set all about Mark's return to The Flash's Rogues Gallery. If you don't have that set, trust me, you definitely want it. If you already own it and you want to give it to a friend who's not already hooked on the show, that would make you the best friend ever, so you can get it that way. Details on how you can score season one of The Flash on Blu-ray absolutely free are coming up later in the show, so stick around for that. Now, if this is your first visit to the Comic Book Central Lair, welcome. So glad to have you on board. It's going to be a fun one today. After today's show, you're definitely going to want to go back and check out past episodes of Comic Book Central. Oh, so many guests. Guests like Stan Lee, William Shatner, the cast from the Arrowverse shows, the Marvel movies, Batman 66, Firefly, Star Trek, The Bionic Woman. They're all out there waiting for you. Over 160 episodes, more than 200 celebrity guests. Man, where can you find them? Only one place, Comic Book Central. And the lair is everywhere. The website, comicbookcentral.net. That's the online hub of Comic Book Central. Each and every episode is located there in the archive. You can download them or stream them right at the website. A complete episode guide is in the About section on the Facebook page, so you can find them all there as well. Links to Comic Book Central on Facebook and Twitter, they are there on the website, as is a link to the show on iTunes. That's the best way to get each and every episode. You subscribe to the show on iTunes, you get them all. Leave a review in iTunes if you're digging what you're hearing. You're definitely going to be digging what you're hearing today. Blueberry, Stitcher, Google Play, they're all out there as well. All episodes are waiting for you on those services, so go check them out. 40 years of Star Wars, 25 years of the Joker on Batman the Animated Series. The Trickster has been returning to The Flash annually. A lot to get to today. And as you're going to hear, we're going to jump headfirst into the pop culture waters today. Who knows where the current's going to take us. Let's get a little bit of background on my special guest, and then I will sit down with the legendary Mark Hamill. Mark was born in California. He is one of seven children, and because his dad was in the Navy, the family moved around a lot. Mark was raised here in the States and abroad, and he graduated high school in Japan. After moving back to California, he studied drama and theater arts at Los Angeles City College, and he went on to appear in some of the biggest television shows of the 70s, like The Partridge Family, Room 222, and One Day at a Time. He even appeared as David Bradford, the eldest sibling on the pilot episode for Eight is Enough. But instead of battling brothers and sisters on ABC, Mark went on to battle the Galactic Empire in the landmark sci-fi film from the mind of George Lucas, Star Wars.
Too short for a stormtrooper?
Huh? Oh, the uniform.
I'm Luke Skywalker. I'm here to rescue you.
You're who?
I'm here to rescue you. I've got your R2 unit. I'm here with Ben Kenobi.
Ben Kenobi? Where is he?
Come on.
Now, we all know the story. Space farm boy becomes a Jedi Knight, saves the galaxy. The original Star Wars trilogy goes on to make billions at the box office and in merchandising, and Mark Hamill became an international star. Outside the Star Wars phenomena, Mark has played against type, on screen in films like the World War II epic The Big Red One with Lee Marvin, and on Broadway in productions like The Elephant Man and Amadeus. In the 90s, he went from hero to villain, first as James Jesse, a.k.a. The Trickster, on the live-action CBS series The Flash. Now, The Trickster, created by writer John Broome and artist Carmine Infantino, first appeared in Flash issue 113 in 1960. And 3 decades later, Mark Hamill made the role his own with 2 memorable madcap performances as the jovial jester. 2 years after that, he joined the all-star cast of Batman the Animated Series as he went behind the microphone to voice Batman's greatest nemesis, the Joker.
Justice will be served, Joker.
Service with a smile?
Clean up your act, Joker.
Oh, that's a joke, right? Batman finally told a joke.
And Mark continued to voice the clown Prince of Crime through numerous animated DC series, feature films, and video games, and he recently returned to the role in Justice League Action and the feature-length adaptation of the classic Batman Joker graphic novel, The Killing Joke.
I've demonstrated there's no difference between me and everyone else. All it takes is one bad day. That's how far the world is from where I am. Just one bad day.
And Mark also made a triumphant return as the Trickster on episodes of the CW hit series The Flash.
I've had 20 years to come up with the perfect trick. It's going to be my masterpiece, my Mona Lisa, my Breaking Bad Season 5. They gave me cable in prison so I'd stop killing the guards.
And after more than 30 years away from the galaxy far, far away, he came back to the role that made him a star in Star Wars The Force Awakens. Now, even though his appearance in The Force Awakens was a non-speaking cameo at the end of the film, the spirit of Luke Skywalker permeated the entire movie. With the Episode 8 sequel, The Last Jedi, set to premiere at the end of this year, fans are eagerly anticipating the fantastic full-length feature return of Luke Skywalker to the Star Wars universe. Now, my guest today is an actor, writer, producer, and director. He has portrayed one iconic character after another in his career. His latest projects include the TV and online series Pop Culture Quest and a small independent film set for release later this year. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. A big welcome to Jedi, Joker, and fanboy extraordinaire, Mr. Mark Hamill. Mark, welcome to
Comic Central.
Hi, Joe. Hey, how are you?
Good.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today. Pop Culture Quest. This is right in your wheelhouse, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it came out of a natural instinct of mine. You know, I was collecting so many things over the years, and it just got ridiculous. I mean, when you get to the point where you're having to hire, like a garage to store your collection, that's no fun. We have storage space 90 minutes away from here. As I was closing the door on the garage, I said, I'm never going to see this stuff again, and I've really got to get this under control. And so Pop Culture Quest was my desire to still be around collectors and to see people's prized possessions, but not having to physically take on any more items. So it's really sort of like, show me your stuff.
Could you do the Mark Hamill Museum? I mean, is it that expansive?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of scattered all over. We have one of the only basements in Malibu, and that's filled up, and we have an attic, and that's filled up. And The pool house is filled up.
You used to get like one of everything from Star Wars, right? Like everything that came
I
out.
I did, but you know, with that, I mean, Nathan was born, my eldest son was born when we were making Empire Strikes Back, and he's our real Star Wars baby. He knows much more about the details of it, you know, reads Star Wars Insider and really follows the minutiae of it. You know, I think he watches Clone Wars and so forth. So I always turn over the items to him because he's like a curator at a museum. He archives everything and labels them. And, you know, it's just one of those things where I'm interested in Star Wars memorabilia, but not as much as Nathan.
Okay. Are you still getting like one of everything? Is that, did you work out a sweet deal?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Okay. I think they narrowed it over the years to, you know, instead of one of everything, when it went supernova, they started saying, well, we'll send you one of everything that has to do with the character of Luke.
Okay. And so you don't have like a room full of Jar Jar Binks or anything like that?
No, but I'd be happy to have that. Okay. I mean, I'm always defending Jar Jar.
I know you are. In filming the series, what did you discover about the collecting mindset? And that's part of you. You have it as well. But what did you discover about the collecting mindset that maybe you didn't know before?
Like, for instance, they were lining up topics for various shows. And I know that Lionsgate wanted us to do a show about this guy who collects Nike shoes. And I said, you know, I don't really get it. I mean, it didn't seem that interesting to me. It's not something that I would guess that anybody collected. And it was one of my favorite shows. And that's what I discovered was it doesn't really matter if you're interested in the specific item as much as that shared passion for collecting. He turned out to be a really interesting guy with a fascinating collection, you know, with you know, these all these specialty shoes and so forth. But I guess that's what I'm trying to say is that there's a certain mindset that unites all collectors, regardless of the specific items. You know, I don't collect Barbie and Ken, but the people that do are similar in terms of just their sensibilities and how they, you know.
Is it a passion that's reflected in other areas of their life? Is it nostalgia? Is it,
I mean, there's just a little bit of everything. All of that. Mm. I think a lot of it is remembering what made us happy as children or as younger people and wanting to continue. So, I mean, I always figured I'd look at my father or older role models and think, well, at some point, I guess I'm not going to be interested in comic books and sitcoms and hand puppets and, you know, Laurel and Hardy. I'll outgrow it. But I realize that the things that I loved as a kid, I still love as a grown-up, which is fantastic for me. For somebody who loved cartoons and games and comic books and all that sort of thing, as a kid, to be able to do what I do and get paid for it, it's like pinch me time. I just can't believe it. So that's what happened with Pop Culture Quest.
Well, I think you and I have that in common too, because I, unfortunately, when I was 16, I sold all my Star Wars stuff. When I was 16, I sold all my Star Wars stuff.
Oh, you sold it all?
At a yard sale for $20. I was 16. I was growing up. Girls aren't going to like this. And I've spent every waking moment trying to get it all back.
So, I know. People do that. They wind up trying to reacquire their collections. But, you know, that's part of the fun of it. I mean, I'm old school. I mean, I remember being a collector in the days before the internet where you just couldn't. You know, you really had to go to yard sales and flea markets and swap meets and, you know, that sort of thing to find the items you wanted. Now, of course, you can just go on online and Google the items. So I miss the sort of the thrill of the hunt.
Do you do that now at all? Like when you're out traveling, because you're traveling all over the place, are you going to flea markets? Do you go in and look for stuff? And if so, what do you
do? Yeah, I do, absolutely. I love going on location in really obscure areas, because you'll find these mom and pop stores, and that's part of the fun. I mean, you know, you hear about people that make these incredible discoveries, and I'm not somebody, you know, that found an action number one at an antique store in Vermont, but you read those stories and those things do happen. So even though I'm not actively collecting as much as I used to, there's still that glimmer of the collector in me.
Where did the interest in comic books come from? How early of an age, and which comic books and
well,
TV
one of my
shows?
Earliest memories of in my life is the fact that I discovered that people were delivering comic strips to my doorstep every day in the newspaper, and that's even before I could read. I was reading a lot of the silent strips like Little King and Henry, and you know, the simplistic comic strips like Nancy and Sluggo and so forth. I know it helped me learn to read. It made me want to read. And I loved cartooning. I loved trying to copy the figures. And I was a big Charles Schulz fan.
You originally wanted to be a cartoonist, right? That was what you...
I did. Yeah. I just didn't have, you know, one of the things that separates the pros from the wannabes is that, you know, the pros can draw an object from any angle and make it look the same or similar, you know, and I just didn't have the skills. But I did really read up a lot about cartoonists, and one of the attractive aspects of that profession is that you can, you know, work out of your home, which was fascinating to me. I think I saw some kind of profile on Charles Schulz, and I saw him, you know, get up from the breakfast table and take his cup of coffee out to the backyard, and there, you know, he had a studio.
He was at work.
And he created his whole world, you know, from his desk. And so I was really fascinated with cartoonists, and, you know, as I graduated to comic books, I think I saw the Superman TV show before I ever saw a Superman comic. And when I first saw a Superman comic, I went, oh, look, it's based on the TV show. Well, what a shock it was, because when you read comic books, especially in that era, that Mort Weisinger era of fantasy, you know, the Bottle City of Candor and Laurie Lamaris and Mr. McSpitalix and all the sort of heavy fantasy that was going on in those comics at the time, there was no budget on an artist's imagination. So, I mean, I just was instantly attracted to... I mean, I didn't start out with superheroes. I liked the Mad reprints that my older brother had in paperback form, which I didn't even realize were reprints of when Mad was a comics book. You know, I love that early stuff, you know, the Will Elder and Super Duper Man and Starchy and all the parodies of the
all the funny
the
stuff.
Comic.
Yeah, I think a lot of us did that with Archie's and, you know, like Sad
Uncle
Sack.
Scrooge. And, yeah, and I was just thinking, not only did I liked Archie, but I especially loved Little Archie by Bob Bowling, who created that whole, like, alternate look. I mean, it was like a whole different Archie than the teenage version.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, Uncle Scrooge, I loved all of that. Anything I could get my hands on. And really, since my dad was in the Navy, I went to 9 schools in 12 years, and we always moved in the summer. And so many instances where you'd see a kid sitting out on the curb reading his comic books, and that would be the starting point for a friendship, because you only had so much money and you had to share whatever you had with other guys. I mean, countless summer afternoons where you'd go over to your friend's house, go down in the basement where it's vaguely cool, and just read comic books all day. I'm pretty much not exchanging a word until, you know, the mother came down and said, your mom just called, you know, you're late
you
for dinner.
You gotta go home, that's exactly. That's when you knew the day was over. Where did the interest in acting come from then? So cartoonists didn't go well, so where did the interest in acting come from then?
Well, I mean, I was a mimic. I liked to imitate actors' voices. I was especially enamored of all the Universal horror films, so I was, you know, trying out my Boris Karloff and trying to figure out where did he get that accent. And you'd read about it. And the days before the internet, you had to actually go to the library. And you go, oh, he was born in England. William Henry Pratt. Okay. Bela Lugosi. Who in the world talks like this? I don't know. You know, I said, where does this guy come from? My dad would say, he's Dracula. He comes from Dracula land. But, you know, I mean, obviously he was from Hungary. So I was then Peter Lorre, all of them. In fact, I've also often credited Claude Rains in The Invisible Man as part of the inspiration for my Joker voice, even though I didn't consciously at the time say I'm going to do Claude Rains. That Invisible Man speech that I remembered from, you know, when I was 8 years old, crazy, you think I'm crazy, I'll show you who's crazy. That grit and that sort of menace was a starting point anyway. Because with voiceover, a lot of times you take elements of various other actors or other voices of historical figures and kind of mix them together. And it took me years to realize that it wasn't something that I had dreamed up myself, because I remember saying to one of the people, they were talking about a character I did on, I think it was Phantom 2000, something like that. And I said, well, he's sort of
Phantom 2040? Yeah,
2040, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a mix of Jay Leno with a little cadence of Howard Cosell.
Not
particularly accurate imitations of Howard Cosell or Jay Leno, but just that kind of the rhythms and delivery. And I said, and then when you meld the two, you come up with a voice that is original. And so many of the established voiceover actors said, oh my gosh, I do that all the time. So it was something I sort of thought I found on my own, but it was something that is commonplace. And I love the fact that in voiceover, it's the very definition of a character actor, because since you cannot be seen, you embody that character with your voice alone. And for someone that was born too late for radio, I did a show when I was a teenager, the Hanna-Barbera version of I Dream a Genie, and then I didn't work in animation for 20 years.
Corey Anders, yeah, and you got to sing too.
You know how that happened?
Do you remember the lyrics?
I was sitting in the office, and Hoyt Curtin, who's the composer who wrote Flintstones and Jetsons and all the classic Hanna-Barbera songs, he stuck his head out and he said, "Hey, kid, do you sing?" And of course, you learn in this business, never say no. You say yes. Somebody had just had car trouble, like a professional singer was going to come in and do that track, and he had me come in and do it, and of course I was really thrilled. But it's a funny thing. That show was like one of the number one rated shows.
I loved it.
In its first season. But you know what they did for the second season? Instead of renewing and having them do a new batch of shows, they just reran season one.
Yeah.
And of course our ratings just plummeted. And we wound up only doing one season. I forget how many it was in those days, maybe 24, 25.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I really loved voiceover arts. And remember, this was the last show directed personally by Joe Barbera. And I'm sitting at the table with Dawes Butler and John Stevenson and Don Messick. I mean, the old school people that I had grown up listening to on Yogi Bear and Rough and Ready and Huckleberry Hound and all the Hanna-Barbera shows. So I was just, even as a kid, I remember going into record stores and looking in the children's records section and writing down names on the Bullwinkle albums or on the Disney albums. I said, oh, okay, Clarence Nash, that's Donald Duck. I mean, I was a student.
Oh, you knew
of
them,
voiceover.
Like you knew who, before we all knew who voiceover artists were, yeah.
Well, also, too, I mean, I love comedy records, and one of the ones that I had as a kid was the single of Dragon Net by Stan Freberg. And June Foray was the female voice, and my ear, I said, oh, my God, that's the lady that does the witch, you know, Witch Hazel in the Looney Tunes, and she's the old hag on Rocky and Bullwinkle, and she's Natasha Fatal, and she's Rocky, she's all these characters. So, yeah, I was really into stand-up comedians and watching the Steve Allen show and all the talk shows. And so I was really drawn to show business. I didn't really know how or to go about doing it, because, you know, I didn't know anybody in show business, but I liked puppets. I loved putting on shows. I had an amateur magic kid and all these things. So I had a big family. I was the middle of seven kids, four sisters, two brothers, and raucous, and you know, we would put on shows. I'd get neighborhood kids, and you know, my brothers and sisters would always be there to heckle on my act. But
did you get to charge any neighborhood kids to see anything?
I don't know. Probably tried nickel? To get a nickel or a couple of pennies out of them. Who knows? In
that's
those days, you know, you could.
That's a payday.
Remember, the comic books were 12 cents at one point.
That's a paid gig, so, and that's a couple of those, and you get some comic books.
Exactly. I mean, I remember when they went from 10 cents to 12 cents, I said, oh, this really throws off my game.
Yeah.
Because in the old days, you go with a quarter, get two comic books and a candy bar. But that extra 2 cents just threw everything into chaos.
I think I was at 15. I think I came in around 15 or 20.
So you got me beat by a few years. Right. But, you know, when that happened, you wound up getting two comic books and a piece of bubble gum. But that was the currency. And so, I mean, I had in my mind that, you know, I remember I was a devoted reader of Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine because I saw King Kong when we were living in New York on a $1 million movie. They ran it every Monday through Friday for a week, for 5 days, and it just devastated me. I mean, it was, to me, the most tragic story ever told. I just lost it. I was just I was in tears, and, of course, I loved the dinosaurs. I didn't know how they did them and so forth, and I watched it the next day hoping somehow he would avoid, you know, being caught and captured and brought to Manhattan. You know, it was just an epic tragedy in my mind. But to me, how did they make these dinosaurs move? And it wasn't until an article in Famous Monsters that I learned about stop frame photography. And it's similar to when I would watch these Walt Disney shows where they would show the making of, Babes in Toyland. And so you'd see the movie making process. And I kept thinking, wow, if I can't make it as an actor, you know, I mean, at the very least, I could probably be a caterer and get on
somewhere,
set and make food for people.
Get in the door.
You know, I didn't need to be in the show, but I wanted to be around the show. So when I would audition for school plays and so forth, you know, occasionally I'd get cast, but if I didn't, I'd always be working props or backstage or making posters or being a usher. I mean, I just had to be at the show. So I knew early on that's what I wanted. I just had to be very careful about who I confided in because, you know, you open up yourself for mockery if you admit you want to go into, hey, Mr. the movie star, how are you this morning? So I wanted to avoid that, and I just really didn't know how to go about doing it. I had a vague notion, well, if you want to make it in the theater, you go to New York. If you want to make it in TV and movies, you go to Los Angeles. But just the most basic knowledge. So, I mean, in my roundabout way, I'm trying to answer your question that I love to make people laugh. And another thing, there was a very empowering moment when I was like in fifth grade. I hosted the variety show. And believe it or not, I had the nerve to bring my Jerry Mahoney ventriloquist.
Oh, no,
I sat for hours in front of the mirrors trying to talk without moving my lips.
You've got to find some film
of Paul
this
Winchell.
Somewhere.
I was a huge fan of Sherry Lewis. And they were my two favorites. And one thing I discovered was you could get away with murder if you had the dummy. You could like insult the cafeteria food and make jokes about, you know, teachers and so forth, and then immediately say, oh, that's terrible, don't say that about Mr. Mendez, he's a very nice guy. Yeah, maybe to you, he's not to me. I mean, and the power of being able to make jokes and then take no responsibility, it transformed me. I didn't become a ventriloquist, obviously, but the power of laughter and the power you have in front of an audience, it's really it had a profound effect on me.
That instant reaction, that's got to be just your adrenaline level just goes up. Just a side plug for your show, Pop Culture Quest, if you want to see Mark Hamill meet King Kong, go watch Pop Culture Quest. That's all we need.
That was astonishing.
I'm not
going to
ruin
now
it for anybody. Just they need to watch it. It's so cool.
Bob Burns has that original armature.
Yeah, he does. How cool is he?
So when you're holding it in your hands, it's just Yeah. I mean, it's
you're
unlike...
holding history. Yeah.
Exactly.
You're Indiana Jones. You're Indiana Jones right then.
The only other moment I felt that sort of came close to that was when Danny Harrison invited us out to Friar Park and brought us up to his dad's guitar room. And he's got, you know, 150 guitars mounted on this massive room. And he's taking guitars and saying, here's what George played at the Cavern. Here's what Dad played in the Hello Goodbye video. That's the psychedelic painting. He used Patty's nail polish the night before they did it. And you're just quivering thinking, I mean, because I'm a huge Beatlemaniac. And like you say, it's living history. It's hard to even process, you know, that you're holding the King Kong armature or you're holding George's guitar that he played on the Ed Sullivan Show. It's just mind-boggling.
Or your own lightsaber from Return of the Jedi. So,
well, see, but see, there you go. See, I'm a fan, and I was a fan long before I worked with George Lucas. So, I mean, one of my first jobs was the Night Gallery, you know, which was sort of a paled in comparison to a classic like Twilight Zone, but I was just beside myself just thinking, oh, I can't believe this. Because, you know, going back to, like, the article about stop-frame animation or watching Clarence Nash in a documentary about making cartoons and seeing him do Donald Duck, the light went off in my head. I might have been 4, 5, 6. I went, wow, somebody go with the I'm talking about Donald Duck. The famous monsters didn't come until I was, like, 12 or so. But when you finally realize, wait a minute, somebody goes to work and their job is to talk for Donald Duck, or it's his job to make dinosaurs come to life. I thought, that's the job I want. And again, in any capacity, I thought, you know, if I don't have the skills to be a stop frame animator, I could be a camera assistant. I could be the coffee boy. I just thought, this is what I want desperately. And my older brother was that way, but about medicine. You know, he became a doctor, but he knew at a very young age, I'd say, oh, Bill, why are you picking up? He would, like, pick up roadkill and go put it in the freezer then dissect it over the weekend. I just had no stomach for that. But he was always interested in that from an early age, so he knew what he wanted.
Well, you made the right choice, I think.
Thanks.
For us, at least. So, hey, look, if I don't get to some of these iconic characters, my listeners are going to have my head. Let's talk heroes before we talk villains. Happy 40th anniversary, my friend. Man.
I know. Time flies.
Yeah, it does. Where are you going to be May 25th this year?
You know, I don't really know.
Are you fibbing?
Am I what?
Are you fibbing?
No.
Because we know you're under this, like, huge protective contracts now.
No. I know they have some activities planned. I know they're doing celebration.
That's April, and then you got, are you going to, like, Star Wars Day?
Yeah. They have May the 4th now that's become sort of this de facto Star Wars Day, which I think is hilarious because... what other movies gets a day?
None! Yours!
Gone with the
your
wind
movie!
Didn't get a
yes,
day.
Your movie does. That's why.
Oh, I know.
That's
it's
because
shocking.
You're Mark Hamill. Look, if I told 26-year-old Mark Hamill, if 40 years from now this movie would be bigger than ever and that he would be starring in the latest entry in the series, what would he have said?
I would have said, arrest this man. He's obviously disturbed. Listen, I thought, you know, of course... Again, we're going back to the early days of, you know, VHS and home video and all that. I thought, you know, 4 or 5 years after the last one came out, it would sort of, you know, it would always have a presence of some sort, but never the longevity that it's had. And partly the reason was that George told us at some point, look, after the prequels, after episodes 1, 2, and 3, that's it. I'm not doing 7, 8, 9 because I don't want to be doing these things in my 70s, which I totally understood. And also, too, I never thought that if they did a third trilogy that we would be involved. I just figured it would be all new characters, and it didn't occur to me that that I would be involved. I mean, obviously, George said, I'm not doing them, you know? I mean, then there was the famous meeting in the summer of 2012, we knew something was up because he asked Mary Lou, my wife, and I to come to lunch with Carrie, but he asked that my daughter go to lunch with George's daughter. In other words, they didn't want anybody else in the room. So
okay, so you knew something was up, something more than just, hey, can you go do the latest version or walk a red carpet?
Well, I thought, you know, what it usually is, you know, the movie's coming out on Blu-ray, we want to do a new
documentary. Yeah, my 18th version of it, yeah.
Exactly. And so, I mean, I'm always I want to aid George any way I can, but I was sort of cynical about it. I said, oh, well, they're releasing the movies in 3D. You watch. He's going to ask us to do some kind of promotional material. And Mary Lou said, what if he wants to do a new trilogy? And I just laughed.
She knew.
I just thought, you know, I said, he told
us
he's not doing that.
Yeah,
so
she knew.
When he actually said what he said, which was, well, you know, I've decided to turn over the company to Kathy Kennedy, and they want to do a new trilogy, and if you don't want to do it, we will write your character out. We won't recast.
Oh, like he would have done that. Like he would have done that.
Well, I kept a poker face,
yeah.
I have to tell you, Joe. I mean,
Of course.
Inside, I was just absolutely stunned.
Stunned in what way, though? Stunned good or stunned, oh, no?
Well, probably a little of both, because, I mean, you know, there's a part of you that wants to rise to any challenge, and then there's the other part that thinks, well, wait a second, we had a beginning, a middle, and an end. I was sort of thinking, I don't know, it's kind of dangerous to bring it back. And, you know, the fans can be so hypercritical. I mean,
right.
There's a difference between not liking a movie and saying it ruined your childhood. So I know how caustic some of the critics can be. So I thought, well, I don't know. I mean, within 30 seconds of George saying that we want you back, Carrie Fisher went, I'm in! And he even said, is there anything for Billy in it? And later, of course, Billy was in the movie. But
yeah.
I said, Carrie, poker face.
Yeah,
poker
yeah.
face. You don't just immediately scream out, I'm
in.
You
have to negotiate.
Exactly. But she was, you know, I mean, obviously she was very smart and said, well, look, you know, what roles are there for women in their 50s?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a blessing in disguise.
Yeah.
And
She is so missed.
But I can't even process it. I mean, she's so present tense in my mind.
Yeah. My wife and I just said that the other day. It's like, I keep thinking she's going to show up on a talk show with Gary.
Yeah,
and just be her. It was we saw her one woman show, and it was just like the funniest night of our lives. Anyway,
obviously, you know, you have her to look forward to in episode 8, but it's cast this terrible melancholy over the experience because it was so untimely.
Yeah, but like you said, we do get that performance, so we are. I think, and I've even mentioned this on the show. I said I'm looking forward to this in a bittersweet fashion. It's like I'm so stoked
right.
that there's a new Star Wars movie. It's her last performance. I got to ask you, did you see Rogue One?
I did.
Okay.
I loved it.
Okay.
I just loved it.
Yeah.
And it's probably now, you know, because I don't ask to go visit sets, you know, because I always figure these people are doing their work. It's distracting. I don't want to be a burden. But Kathy Kennedy said, Gareth Edwards said that he'd love it if you could drop by the set today because they were, you know, shooting at Pinewood. And I said, I'd love that. You know, when is it going to be? She said, whenever, this Thursday. So I dutifully put on my Godzilla shirt, which actually I'm wearing right now, that olive green one that they put out for Gareth's version of Godzilla. And I can tell this story because the movie's been out long enough, but he said 5 words to me, which were the worst spoiler of all time. And I'll tell you how it came about. because I was on the set and I met Felicity and she's lovely, and you know, I didn't know anything about the story vaguely. I knew it was about, you know, trying to steal the plans of the Death Star and so forth, and it immediately preceded episode 4 and all that. But I'm like, if I'm not involved, I don't want any spoilers. I don't want to read the script. You know, I want to be.
Yeah.
I like surprises.
Yeah. I mean, we know they're all going to die. I mean, we get that because they have to die. But other than that.
Well, no, not really, though. I mean, just because they don't show up in 4, I mean, that wasn't a given in my mind. I mean, okay. It's not something I thought about. But I have to tell you, when I was on set,
go ahead. Your spoiler. I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Your spoiler, your 5-word spoiler.
No, no. Well, you're hinting at what happened, because I was telling Gareth, I said, you know, one of the great advantages of a standalone film is the fact that you can get it on, get it done, and get off leaving people wanting more rather than following the structure of a 3-film trilogy. And one of the problems with prequels is that, you know, Obi-Wan can't die because he shows up later, and, you know, with a movie like this, you know, there's that element of surprise because you don't know what's going to happen. And he went, in this one, everyone dies. And I almost just fainted dead away. I said, what did you, what? What did you just say? He was so casual about it.
Yeah,
and
but
listen,
okay.
We are so schooled in being not revealing any spoilers,
right,
you know,
right.
Being careful about choosing our
trust
words.
Trust me, I know.
Not,
I've talked to you before. Yeah, you're very, very careful.
It's terrible.
I mean, know.
People take. I was speaking at a school in England, and you know, I was talking about Daisy Ridley, and I was talking about how talented she is, and how wonderful she is, and how adorable she is, and I thought, wow, this kind of is vaguely verging into creepy, you know, dirty old man territory, because I was talking about how...
Yeah, dial it in. Right, yeah.
And so I tried to fix it by saying, I look at her, I'm speaking from a very fatherly point of view. Well, the audience just gasped.
I've seen it.
Like, I had revealed, you know, some secret of the,
it's
the
audible.
Upcoming movie.
Yeah, it's audible. You can hear the gap.
Oh, my God.
And the look
and
on your face
up.
Is amazing, yeah.
He hints that he's Ray's father and all that stuff. And
love
so, I mean,
it.
You know, that's one of the things we're not used to, is how high the speculation is. Because, you know, I remember back in the day when, you know, when we were making Star Wars, no one really cared. They didn't tell you to not show your script to other people. It was not an issue.
Or if it did, it didn't get into Starlog magazine until months later or something. Yeah, it wasn't a huge deal like it is today. At the end, look, everybody's seen it by now. At the end, we have a CGI, Carrie Fisher as Leia. Just thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I was astonished with what they did with Peter Cushing, because I had seen footage, and I can't remember if it was the trailer or going into a dubbing session where I saw some footage. I thought, you know, that maybe the with his back to the camera and the reflection in the glass might be the entirety of his role. So I was astonished at how they utilized the character in a way, in an extensive way. And, you know, you sort of get used to it. I thought they did a great job. You know, it's sort of that blurring between, you know, CGI and video games and movies that's happening, and, you know, it gets better and better and better. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that Carrie had done that, and or at least, you know, she never had a vault. She'd always, you know, spill her guts and tell you everything. So she did keep that a secret from me. I might have staged it where she was a little bit further away from the camera and maybe the lights being down a little bit more. I mean, that one was harder for me to accept than Cushing, but it was a very effective moment, because, you know, finally you come full circle to that moment just before she puts the plans into R2. So I just thought the whole movie was just fantastic. I just was, it was a thrill. to see it. We got to see it at the White House, you know, with a bunch of servicemen's kids, and it was, you know, I mean, again, I loved it in every way, and I think the standalone films, like the young Han Solo. Now, I don't know anything about it, but the way Rogue One was intoned, sort of like a gritty World War II movie, I think the young Han Solo could be really sort of like in the mold of Tom Jones or one of those body comedies about a rogue and a scoundrel and a womanizer. So it could have a much lighter, funnier, the Sting kind of tone where he's, you know, pulling scams with young Lando and all that. I mean, the potential for these standalone films is limitless because they can really be their own stories without having to, because there's certain things that people expect from a proper Star Wars film, and I think they're onto something really smart with these standalones.
Okay, so you're okay with the move, with the characters being rebooted with younger actors, and the reason I ask this is because it's not like Superman where, you know, it's the character preceded everything and it's a bunch of actors. You created the characters along with George Lucas and the writers and producers, but these are your characters. Harrison Ford is Han Solo. Mark Hamill is Luke Skywalker. Carrie Fisher is Princess Leia. You're okay with them rebooting with younger actors?
Well, they're going to do what they have to do. I mean, obviously, these movies are going to be going on for years and years and years, and probably long after I'm gone. But, you know, they got to do what they got to do. I mean, it's a hard thing. I mean, who would want to be young Han Solo? I mean, I'm sure that actor's terrific, but, you know, when they did the, you know, Butch and Sundance, the early years, and both were really good actors, but, you know, it was, in people's minds, it was Paul Newman and Robert Redford. I mean, I think it's going to be easier than I might make it sound, because it's Han Solo at an age where he's probably in his early 20s or something like that. So, you know, it's like 20 years before you hooked up with him in Star Wars. But, yeah, there's so much potential. You know, I mean, I thought maybe they would focus on more obscure characters, you know, do a Yoda story or, you know, a story of how the droids hooked up in the beginning. I don't know. I mean, who knows? But it's certainly in good hands. I mean, it's the guys that did the Lego movie. They're smart and funny.
Okay. You're the same age, about close to, as Sir Alec Guinness was when he was Obi-Wan Kenobi.
That's
was there
right.
anything you took from him, looking back now, of what being able to work with him that you're able to sort of channel now as Luke Skywalker?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, watching him was like the best, you know, acting workshop, acting class you could have. So I'd like to think that, especially in playing a character that's now, as you say, closer in age to the Jedi that he played, that there's an economy of movement and an internal sort of dynamic that's going on where less is more. I mean, he was just beyond great. And it's funny, too, because, I mean, I remember when we were talking, he admitted to me one time how much he had studied Stan Laurel. And I thought, because, you know, we were talking about Man in the Man in the White Suit, which is one of my favorite Ealing comedies. And the fact that he would admit that he consciously wanted to sort of mirror that innocence, that childlike innocence and sort of blank visage of Stan Laurel. He was an amazing person. You know, like I, every chance I had, you know, between takes, as long as I wasn't bothering him, you know, to be around him and be able to ask him questions about, you know, various things. But he was funny, you know, you'd be talking about the Lady Killers or Lavender Hill Mom, and, no, I don't want to talk about my career. Let's hear about your career. I think, really, you want to hear about my guest star role on the Partridge Family? Come on. Yes, not only was I lucky to work with him, I realized, I said, gee, I'm never going to be able to, I don't have any scenes with Peter Cushing. So I made sure that I went to work a couple of days when he was working and got to meet him as well.
That's when you crashed the set.
That's when I crashed the set. But, you know, it's funny because, you know, speaking of Stan Laurel, he was amazed in the days of, you know, now you can just Google anything. But in those days, in 1976, he was really stunned that I knew that he was in A Chump at Oxford. In his early 20s, he played one of the students. You know, of course, it was shot here in Southern California, and I asked him about that experience. And he also played opposite Leslie Howard in The Man in the Iron Mask, where he played the twin opposite Leslie Howard before, you know, they cut him out and melded up the two images of Leslie Howard. And I said, that must have been terrible, you know, being in a movie that you knew you were going to be cut out of. He said, no, on the contrary, the fact that I knew I was not going to be on screen, I had the ability to learn so much technically and not feel any sort of performance anxiety because I knew that I eventually would be cut out of the movie. But he, like Guinness, was just a font of information you know, as a movie lover, you know, I mean, I was all over it. Because, I mean, this man could play anything. Cushing, you know, he could play Sherlock Holmes and he could play Dr. Frankenstein and he could play evil. He was just a consummate actor, and what a you know, the both of them were, you know, just the epitome of British gentlemen.
Bigger surprise for you, returning as Luke Skywalker or the Trickster?
Wow, both of them. I mean, and Wing Commander too. I have this. There's this whole theme of coming back to franchises I hadn't thought about in years. I mean, when I watched The Flash from the very first episode, because I knew John Wesley Shipp was playing Barry's father, and I'm very fond of John, and I think he's a terrific actor. And I thought it was so clever. I said, boy, you know, they have it all over the original Flash series in the sense that they use that storyline where the father's falsely convicted of the mother's murder. So, I mean, there's that thread, you know, that runs through all the episodes. Ours, you know, back in the day, they were standalone episodes without that sort of Greg Berlanti, Andrew Kreisberg ability to, you know, weave these stories so that, you know, they tell self-contained stories, but there's always elements of the plot that need to be resolved in future episodes.
There's
so
the reward
smart.
for repeated
exactly.
viewing. Yeah. So you were watching the show then? You were watching?
I was watching the show,
wow,
exactly,
okay,
and
wow,
I would watch
cool.
it with my daughter, cool. Chelsea, and she loved it. I like it too. Then I hear, you know, through my agent, they want you to return to The Flash. So I'm thinking, well, I'm a contemporary of John's, and so I'll probably play the prison warden. I could play a cellmate. I could play his lawyer. I could play the prison priest. Who knows? Who do they want me to play? When they said the Trickster, I said, are they out of their minds? I mean, it was dodgy rocking that one-piece leotard, you know, 20 years ago, much less the idea. I said, you know, you guys, it just sounds a little bit wrong, age inappropriate. They said, well, come meet with us. Well, we want to tell you our ideas for the Trickster. So, you know, I was happy to hear their ideas. And, you know, what they came up with, I mean, it was so smart. I mean, yeah. they had a Devon Gray playing a younger Trickster wannabe, and I was sort of this Hannibal Lecter type figure who is
creepy,
incarcerated. Yeah, and but really sort of asked to help bring down the this new Trickster. You know, I just thought it was so smart and so well done. So I was happy to go back. I had a great time. The cast is phenomenal. Grant and Jesse and all of them. You know.
You've often said that Star Wars fans know more about the Star Wars movies and the Star Wars Expanded Universe at this point than you do. That's
right.
Not the case with these comic book projects, though, is it?
You
know a little bit.
You know, I have,
you know,
my blind... I mean, I'm sort of more someone that's stuck in the era of comics when I read them. So I'm more sort of Silver Age, and I branched out into Golden Age, and I'm not so on top of the new product that's coming out.
But for the 1990 version, you knew the Trickster.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. In fact, I said, am I going to have those air shoes where I get to run through the sky? Because I thought, that's the pun, right? He's the original Skywalker. But so far, they haven't, you know, done that. You know, I keep thinking, you know, because I got to do... I did a team up with Wentworth Miller and with Liam McIntyre.
Oh.
And Liam gets to fly. I said, I'm so jealous. I mean, Weather Wizard gets to fly.
Yeah.
I said, you'd think that Trickster would come up with some kind of contraption or some sort of gimmick. I always saw him. I said, let's play him almost like Wile E. Coyote, where he comes up with these elaborate Rube Goldberg type over elaborate gimmicks. And, you know,
just short of Acme being written on them.
Exactly, you know, smashing into the mountainside. I just said that's sort of a fun undercurrent we can play with. And
but you did that in the 1990 version, though, didn't you? Like you, that was a Looney Tunes cartoon come to life, especially the second.
Oh, absolutely, especially
the
second
sound
one.
Effects and yeah.
Yeah, well, originally they didn't want to do any costume villains. They were trying to keep it very sort of dark, and you know, they were very much influenced by the Tim Burton Batman films of the time. And the Trickster was the first time they did a costume villain. It was mid-season. I think I was episode 13. And for Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo, who were the head honchos back then, they said, we really missed a trick here. I mean, no pun intended, but in the sense that they thought they could get away with having just evil scientists or motorcycle gangs or drug runners as the villains. But as we all as comic book fans know, you've got to have an over-the-top villain to match the hero. You know, Batman has his Joker, Superman has Lex Luthor, you know, and aside from the Batman's rogues gallery, the Flash probably has the best, you know, villains out there. So, and nowadays, of course, they can do Gorilla Grodd, they can do all these things they were unable to do back in the day. But you're right, the second episode especially, once they found their voice, they had me come back and do the last episode of the season, The Trial of the Trickster, which they later married together and released as a feature on, you know, direct-to video feature overseas, because it was seamless. I mean, they just put up a title 6 months later or
yeah,
whatever.
Right. Yeah, they did that with a lot, like the Spider-Man show in the 70s. And,
right,
there was a lot
right.
Of
but,
yeah.
No, the only reason people know more about the Star Wars universe than I do is that, you know, I don't keep up. I mean, I saw our movies the last time it was in the movie theaters when they re-released them. In 97, I guess it was, so 20 years ago. And even, like, I've only seen Force Awakens twice. I've seen Rogue One once. And I love these movies. But in terms of reading all the ancillary material, you know, the novels and playing the games and reading the comic
it's
books
a lot, yeah.
And watching the animated series, I mean, I just don't have the knowledge that's the real ultra-passionate fans have.
No, but you're definitely a Trickster fan. I talked to Howard Chaykin about the script, and obviously there was, the tone of the show, you referenced the tone of the show. Is it a film noir? Is it a crime drama? Is it an outlandish comic book thing? Was there, like, a darker version of the Trickster episode where he was, that you saw, even in a script, where he was, like, imagining he was the Flash and trying, you know, just, or did you sort of get the script of what was actually on air?
Well, there weren't great changes. I mean, we had a discussion, and they did want to make sure everybody knew that he was crazy and lethal. So, I mean, it's pretty grim. I kill a police officer one of the very first scenes.
Yeah.
So they weren't really fooling around. You know, they try and strike that balance. I mean, it's funny because I used to get letters when I was doing the Batman animated series saying, why doesn't the Joker kill more people? He's all bark and no bite. But, of course, it was made for children, and standards and practices, i.e. the censors, wouldn't allow you to do so many things. You couldn't put a child in jeopardy, or you couldn't push someone through a plate glass window. No drugs, no alcohol, no handguns. I mean, I said, well, wait a minute. I had a Tommy gun a couple of episodes ago. I mean, how come I can have a Tommy gun? They can't. They said, well, children can get their hands on handguns. Children can't get their hands on Tommy guns. So Tommy guns are okay, but handguns are not. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. But
definitely a different version than the Killing Joke, that's for sure.
Well, that's it. I mean, then you come back after all these years and they do the video games and they get, you know, they're rated for mature audiences or whatever, and it gets much more grim, as you say, the, you know, nothing grimmer than the Killing Joke, which, you know, you had 8-year-olds going, oh boy, I can't wait for the new Joker. I said, don't you dare watch it. I mean, someday you can watch it, but not now.
Did you hurt yourself in the Trial of the Trickster?
I did. I jumped out in a rehearsal. I love the fact of telling the story, because at one point I'm supposed to be in the witness box and lunge at my attorney and try and strangle her. And by the way, the actress who played the part of my lawyer, her name is Marcia Clark. Isn't
original,
that something?
And the original, you know, Marcia Clark.
And she, they had a screening of both of these episodes at the movie theater on Fairfax, and everybody came back. Crew members came back. Marcia was there. Corinne Borer, who played Prank, and I never thought she got the credit. I mean, remember, Prank came before Harley Quinn. It's sort of a mirror image, because she's like a groupie for the Trickster, just the way Harley is for the Joker, although she's a psychiatrist. I mean, there are differences, but there are so many similarities that I never asked Paul Dini about it, but I said, I wonder if he saw that, because, and I said to Andrew and to Greg Berlanti, I said, it would really be great if we could bring Corinne back and reclaim the legacy of Prank.
Oh, wow.
And they're very open to it. I mean, I don't want to give anything away. And
no, but maybe Earth 3. Maybe Earth 3.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, and because I said another reason I thought it would be a great idea is I thought Devin Gray was so good as the wannabe Trickster, and I was sorry that, you know, they couldn't bring him back. So maybe we can do it. I mean, I did an episode this season which was just a cameo, you know, and at first I said, you guys, I don't want to go all the way to Vancouver for a cameo. I mean, do you know how hard it is to get into Canada? I mean, their customs are as stringent as any country I've ever been in, and they're practically, you know, the same country as us, so I don't get it. But in any case, at first I hesitated, and I thought, well, wait a second, if it's Earth 3, maybe we can play with the look a little bit. And so I sent a picture of Conrad Veidt in The Man Who Laughs and said, can we make it look like this? And
oh, that was your idea.
They said, sure.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Yeah,
I was wondering if you channeled a little Joker with that, which I guess that was the original inspiration, too.
Well, I thought it would really be kind of fun for the fans, because that when people see a photograph of that makeup, they realize what an influence he was on Jerry Robinson and Bob Kane and Bill Finger to come up with the Joker. I mean, that's certainly the look they had originally. So, and you know, Trickster is sort of a variation on a theme. So,
I love talking to you, cause we get all over the map. I asked you about getting hurt and we got into a weird area. So I apologize.
Oh, I just finished the hurt story.
How bad did you hurt yourself?
The witness box and strangle my lawyer and those curly Q, shoes that I was wearing, those teeny type shoes, got hooked on the edge of the witness box, and I tumbled out and fell right on my face. I didn't pass out, but they sent me to the studio infirmary to make sure I wasn't.
Did you dislocate your shoulder?
No. I just smashed my head pretty hard on the ground and felt like an idiot because. You know, I didn't really have to do it. It was only rehearsal. You're supposed to just sort of give an indication of what you're going to do. But like I say, once I get into that whole gear, I'm so committed. I just went for it.
John Wesley Shipp had mentioned to me when they were done shooting the last episode, he was so relieved. He grabbed the wings off his mask, off his cowl, and flung them into the air, and you got them.
I think I got one of them, and I don't even know where it is right now, but okay. I'm that way, you know, I mean...
He said you jumped
on.
This is
awesome. And by the way, there was a shot of him, I think, just the way the light hit him when we were doing this last one, where he was in the Jay Garrick Flash outfit. And I went, oh, my God. I said, you look like an Alex Ross painting. And he said, what's that? And I said, oh, you haven't seen Alex Ross? He renders all these paintings of comic book characters, but as real people, as realistically as possible. And I'm telling you, I still get the chills as a comic book nerd seeing, because I'm seeing all these things that I never thought I'd see. I never thought we'd see any members of the Justice Society. And, you know, when I was a kid, I was so knocked out by that concept of multiple Earths that I said, oh, man, this is so great, but they'll never be able to do it because it's too expensive or, you know, I mean, we didn't have the CGI and the technology to do it. And to see all of these things realized now, you know, whether it's Legends of Tomorrow or Arrow or how about Riverdale? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Jughead is like the coolest guy on the show.
So you're watching that too?
Oh yeah, yeah. Now I see, it's genius the way they've, you know, reinvented it as this sort of faux Twin Peaksy soap opera thing, you know, where everybody has dark secrets and this and that. But I said, how smart is that? Because when I think of Archie, I always think of, you know, the Bob Montana version, where it's a comedy, definitely, and it just shows you the brilliance of Berlanti. And I don't know if Andrew Kreisberg does Riverdale, but whoever's guiding that show, I mean, it's very, very smart, because I think young people would sort of, you know, if you did it period 50s or period 60s or something, let's remember, Archie was sort of a comic book version of the Andy Hardy movies in the first place. So they're supposed to reflect teenagers in whatever era they exist in. But I didn't see this one coming. I didn't see it as being a drama the way it is.
Yeah, they did an amazing job with it so far. I mean, yeah, we're hooked. I gotta see where this ends up. Hey, by the way, anniversaries. Happy 25th anniversary on Voicing the Joker.
That's right.
Quarter century on that. Tim Curry, the original voice.
Yes.
I think they were looking for something different. You kind of like, you went in, you were another voice on Batman early on.
Right.
And then
here's what happened.
Okay.
I read about it in, what was Maggie Thompson's comic book newspaper that came out every week?
Oh, you got me drawing a blank now.
Well, but anyway, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I would read that, and I read about this plans to do an animated Batman series that was aimed more at true comic book fans, and that it was going to be as far away from Super Friends and the more juvenile interpretations, that their goal was to mimic the Max Fleischer cartoons of the 40s. I said, oh, man, that's great. I mean, it looks like it could be a fantastic show. So I called my agent. I said, I really want to get on Batman. And they called and said, oh, they've given you the role in the Mr. Freeze episode. I said, oh, I get to play Mr. Freeze. They said, no, that's Michael Ancera. You're playing Ferris Boyle, his bot. You're the one that pushes him into the solution. Okay, fine. I mean, that they just gave me. Now I was able to go in, meet the creative team, see the original drawings and the backgrounds and the renderings of all these different characters. And
were you kind of hoping to be a writer, too, maybe, on the series? Or just like...
Well, I'm always interested in that.
Yeah.
I was so... I love, like, in both Tricksters, they allowed me to add so much, you know. In other words, you know, don't know my own strength. I said, there's a Bullwinkle reference in the original, and I was always trying to find ways to put in sly things that were not in the script, and it happened in the new incarnation. You know, they said, you know, like when I was being interrogated in the prison scene, and I would always wait until the first take. I wouldn't do it on rehearsal because I want to surprise people. And the line was, they said, can you tell us where this guy is? And I said, if I knew where he was, I would tell you so you could capture him. And on the take, I said, if I knew, I would tell you so you could cut off his head and throw it right in his face, which was an expression I heard my English teacher use, you know, 20 years, 30 years earlier. And I always loved the absurdity of that visual
extremism,
optical illusion. Exactly. So, I mean, they let me put that in there. I can't. There's something in every trickster version I've done that's mine and mine alone.
You didn't do the I'm your father. That was already in there.
No. Okay. That was their idea.
Right. Okay.
In fact, I said, I wonder if I should say I am your daddy or something to make it a little different. But I think they wanted it to be the way it was for a reason. And, you know, I really trust them so much.
It was the right choice.
That I thought that was an effective moment, especially in context of the way Devin played his role so heartbreakingly real. I mean, I'm sort of this way over the top comic book villain, you know, and in that loopy land. And then when he opens up as this lost kid, I mean, it was heartbreaking. We did my close up before we did his, and I would have totally done it different if I saw how starkly real he played that moment. It was just I was so impressed with him. I mean, I think he's just a terrific young actor.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, coming into the Joker. Yeah. Yeah, you were thinking about Ryder, but coming in. So you were
I go in, I play this one villain. Now, at that time they'd already cast Tim Curry as the Joker, see? So a couple of months go by and then they call and my agent says they want to know if you would audition for the Joker. Now, the prior episode, they just gave it to me. I don't know why. I mean, maybe because I was a celebrity, whatever. And I said, sure. I said, you know, I have to tell you, I really thought there's no way they're going to be able to cast me as the Joker after the way the fans reacted to Michael Keaton being cast as Batman before they even saw the movie. There's no way they're going to be able to cast Luke Skywalker as the Joker. It would just be a public relations nightmare. So I had that confidence knowing that I was going to go audition for a part that they could not give me. So instead of having performance anxiety because I really wanted the part, I was confident in knowing that they couldn't cast me. So I was relaxed, and I was going to have to dub the first handful of episodes because they'd already been animated to Tim's interpretation. And by the way, for years I didn't say who the actor was, and it got out that it was Tim. And I have to tell you a couple of things. It had nothing to do with his performance. He was brilliant as the Joker, as he is in pretty much every part. Now, I was never given an official reason, but I think the Fox executives, he had just played Captain Hook in 65 episodes of Peter Pan and the Pirates. And the interpretation was similar. So who knows? You know, who knows the whims of the studio executives?
I think I'd read it was a little darker and they wanted a little bit more manic. I think that's what I had read.
Something like that, because he was sort of like, well, boys, soon all of Gotham City will be mine. Which was great and terrifying. I love Tim Curry. I'm a major fan. I saw him on stage do Frankenfurter at the Roxy, and he just—I mean, it's like one of the all-time great stage performances.
Yeah.
So, and when I went in and heard his tracks, I said, "Oh my God, he's brilliant!"
Yeah.
And no one ever told me why. I mean, also a theory of mine was he was so busy. He was doing a movie in Mexico, then he's going to England and doing a stage play, then he's on Broadway, then he's going to Australia. I think a lot of it had to do with his scheduling problems, with, you know, how in demand he was. Be that as it may, I went in, I did this audition. Now, mind you, I'd been in Amadeus for 9 or 10 months on the road and on Broadway, and I had experimented a lot with the goofy laugh that Mozart is required to have. Now, you can't change lines in a Broadway show. I mean, you get notes from the stage manager if you say cannot instead of can't. I mean, they're really strict about that, but you could play around with the laugh. And just to keep it interesting for myself, I would say, you know, I'm going to do sort of a Curly laugh, I think, from the Three Stooges, or I'm going to do a Jerry Lewis laugh, or whatever it was. Sometimes I'd get notes, you know, it's getting a little too Jerry, like, whatever. But all I mean, the only reason I bring it up is years later, after doing the role for many, many years, I did ask Andrea Romano, what was it that got me the part, by the way? And she said, oh, definitely your laugh. When
wow.
you did that total, when you just, with complete abandon, laughed, I looked at Bruce Timm and we said, that's the guy. So I was very cocky, thinking, when I was leaving the audition, I said, ah, they're never going to find a better Joker than that, you know. But I knew I couldn't play it, you know. I mean, it wouldn't compute. So when they said I got it, I went 180 degrees from confidence to absolute abject terror that I can't measure up to what people would imagine. Because I said to my agent, look, I wanted to play Two-Face or Clayface or Dr. Hugo Strange, anybody that had never been done before on the Adam West version, in the movies. I mean, I wanted a fresh character. And I said, you know, because everybody thinks of Cesar Romero and my gosh, Jack Nicholson. I mean, who's crazy enough to, as an actor, to follow Jack Nicholson in anything? But
Mark Hamill, apparently.
As it turns out, one of the great joys of animation is that you cannot be seen, and it liberates you to be able to do to make choices that you wouldn't ordinarily make if the camera were on you. And that's what I love about voiceover in general. Now, it's sort of tight me. I'm doing lots of villains now. I'm Gadfly Garnett on Miles from Tomorrowland, and I'm not an out-and-out villain on Milo Murphy's Law. The guys that did Phineas and Ferb have me doing something. What else am I doing? I don't know. I mean, with voiceover, you can rack up a lot of credits and forget about, you know, because, you know, I'll be over on Cartoon Network and go, shh, wait a minute. Hey, I think that gangster raccoon is me, or whatever. You know, it's like a Powerpuff Girls that you forgot you had done four
yeah.
years ago.
Because you're doing so much of it,
tell
yeah.
you. You know, but you do so much, it's volume, 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 and people don't phone you or drop you a card saying, oh, your episode's on this Thursday. So there's a great number of shows I've voiced that I've never heard.
Can you give us the Joker? You got us stoked for it now. I feel like we got to give something to listeners here.
Well, the thing is, I never wanted there to be one Joker laugh. I said, it's almost like the colors in a palette of an artist. It should reflect his mood. In other words,
how about the Joker getting ready to go to London to shoot a blockbuster?
No, I just scared the dog.
I know, I apologize to your dog.
Reared my head back and roared like that. She just went on alert. Like
everything's a comic book property now. What character would you like to play or voice that you haven't yet? There's the whole Marvel universe is open to you. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., there's the Netflix series. I know you're a DC guy, but there's like, you did the Hobgoblin.
No, I like Marvel too. Yeah. Believe me. I who did I do for Marvel?
You did the Hobgoblin.
That's right. I also played in the Hulk. I was Gargoyle, I guess his name was. He was very Peter Lorre, I think. I've done a numerous. I'm on Spider-Man. I mean the new Spider-Man.
Is there somebody you want to play that you haven't yet, or maybe even live action?
You know, I don't think like that. I tell you the truth, when I see these actors, you know, I've never seen or heard a Joker that where I said, oh, that's terrible. There's something about every Joker I've really liked. I mean, even Zach Galifianakis, I think, is hilarious in the Lego. I mean, he's the perfect Joker for that incarnation. Just the way Cameron Monaghan, is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
On Gotham.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's terrific. I don't know if he's the Joker
He could.
Yeah, but he's got that dynamic delivery and that fiery red hair. I just, I thought he was great. I love the Penguin on that show. I mean, but no, there's no role where I'm thinking, gee, I wish I could play X, Y, or Z. I'd love to be in a live action a Marvel movie because they're so clever.
Well, the reason I ask this is I think if my math is right, I think you're the same age as Michael Keaton.
I probably am. He sounds like a contemporary of mine.
Yes, he's playing the Vulture in the new Spider-Man.
Oh, see, now I would have loved to have played that part.
But there's the Hobgoblin in Spider-Man universe.
But that's Willem Dafoe. Of course, if it's a reboot.
That's the Green Goblin. Oh,
right. Okay, Hobgoblin, Green Goblin.
Would you play the Hobgoblin in a live-action version?
You know who I found very personable and so knowledgeable was Kevin Feige?
Kevin Feige.
Right. Mm-hmm. He is so knowledgeable and so smart the way he's guiding these Marvel movies. And I actually, out now, because we were in a backstage holding area at one of those Marvel movies. I forget which one. They asked me to go to the premiere when we were over doing one of the Star Wars movies, since it's Disney. And I said, sure. And so I got to talk. I got up close and personal time with him. And he's really easy to talk to. And I said to him, I said, let me ask you something. Now, I played the Trickster a couple of times on the television arcade incarnations of The Flash. Does that hurt my chances to be in a movie because I've done television? And I don't know whether he was trying to be nice, but he said, no, not at all. I said, because, you know, listen, I'm a huge comic book fan, so please keep me in mind if there anything turns up. He said, oh, we'd love for that to happen. Now, of course, I never got a call, and I understand. I mean, Michael Keaton's one of my favorite actors. He's going to be wonderful in that part. But, you know, okay. I mean, I am so grateful to even be still doing this, at the age of 65 now. I mean, I thought, isn't this the portion of my career where I'm supposed to be puttering around the garden with a metal detector telling people to get off my lawn? I mean, it's fantastic. It's something that I don't take for granted. I'm really grateful.
Part of our nerd brain just exploded. You having a conversation with Kevin Feige about this. We love it. Finishing up with a Mark Hamill speed round. Star Wars or Empire?
Well, I've always said, you know, you love them all for different reasons. It's like saying, what's your favorite child, Nathan Griffin or Chelsea? It's not that easy. But in terms of the challenging the audience and delivering something that was unexpected, darker, deeper, more cerebral, more spiritual than what had come before, I'd have to give the edge to Empire. But that's I really was loath to admit that because, I'm like I say, I just have an instinctive desire to defend, because people say, oh, the Ewoks were too cute and, you know, they ruined the third movie. I said, look, you guys, I find that for 5, 6, 7-year-old kids, that's their favorite one. They love the Ewoks because they're small like them and they're bringing down, you know, all this advanced technology with their, you know, with their primitive tripwires and, you know, catapults and all those things. So, and the same with Jar Jar. I said, look, of course he's annoying. He's supposed to be annoying. He was annoying to the Liam Neeson character. Didn't the Liam Neeson character grab his tongue at the breakfast table? I mean, so I don't know. It's one of those things. I feel like I'm sort of the goodwill ambassador for all of them, even though, you know, it's up to everybody to make up their own minds.
You're fun. Did Han shoot first?
Of course! I don't understand. Listen, George owns these movies. He can do what he likes with them. But it seems to me they should preserve the original just from the standpoint of film history. And yet the originals have been sort of disappeared for the special editions. And I'm sort of torn because I thought, well, it's his to do with as he likes. But for the purists, they want to see what they saw when they were a little kid. And the whole idea of changing the idea of who shot first, because I thought that pretty much defines Solo's character, that he would be somebody, not only shoot first, but shoot under the table. like the exact opposite of like a noble protagonist type, and that's what we liked about Han Solo. He was unpredictable. He was, you know, he blurred the edges between hero and scoundrel. So, but I am sort of old school. They also said, you know, will you stop commenting on the holiday special? And I said, look, you guys, the reason I like the holiday special, I mean, I've never seen the whole thing. I've seen clips over the years, but I, at the time, said, this is a terrible mistake. We shouldn't do this. If we do it, it should be written like a Bob Hope special or something. And that's the problem. It's a mashup with two genres that don't work together. But it shows we're human. It shows we make mistakes. It shows that, you know, we're not infallible. And I said to them, I said, you should embrace it. You should put the holiday special as one of the extras. When they were having us do the documentaries for the movies coming out on DVD, I said, that was my suggestion. And of course, you know, they didn't listen to me.
I love Carrie Fisher singing any chance I can hear it.
I listen. We celebrate a day of peace, of perfect harmony. She was a great singer. Now, I said to George at the time, because I said, I don't want to do this. And he said, oh, come on, we got to do this. You know, people forget, that came out the Christmas of
78.
And the movie had been in the theaters for nearly 18 months, which was unheard of at the time. So he said, do it as a favor to me. It's mostly to keep a presence in people's minds and help with the merchandising and blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, I'll do it for you, George, but I said, but I'm not singing. And he goes, well, you don't like to sing? I said, I love singing. Mark loves singing, but I don't think it's right for Luke. So at the very least, they took me out of the, I didn't have to do a song. But it worked for Carrie, number one, because she's the princess, and number two, she had a great voice.
I still have my original TV guide out and my bootleg version on DVD. Would you consider playing a villain in an Indiana Jones film, or is that too meta?
No, listen, not only would I love that, I would love to be, remember the list of the Adrian Messenger where they had all these Hollywood stars in elaborate makeups where you couldn't recognize them? I think it would be so cool to not even take billing, you know, and, you know, do a bald cap and dark glasses and mustache or something and do an accent. And I love those movies so much, I would love to play a villain. I've always felt that. I mean, I remember when I did Slipstream, I said, if this doesn't get me a Bond villain, nothing will.
Would you please tell Harrison to stop flying for at least a little while?
I told him, listen, when he had that first where he crashed on the golf course, which, what a surprise, there were doctors golfing at the time. I said, you've got to stop this. I mean, please promise me you'll only fly in front of green screen. And, you know, he's got to do what he's got to do. That's him.
George Reeves or Christopher Reeve?
Listen, I mean, you're hitting my sweet spot because George Reeve was my childhood Superman, and he had a bond with the audience that like no other, where he'd look and wink at the camera and all that stuff. So sentimentally, I mean, since he was my first, although Christopher Reeve is just iconic in the role. He was wonderful, too. But so it's trying to, you know, it's trying to choose between Coke and Pepsi.
Betty or Veronica?
Well, Betty's the right choice. Veronica's a challenge. I mean, at least the way she was in the comics, so spoiled and rich and so forth. But she was intriguing. You knew that she would be more of a challenge, but If you were lucky, you'd probably wind up with Betty because you'd have a long, happy life rather than, you know, with Veronica, I would imagine she'd go through four or five husbands.
Superman red underwear or on the outside or not?
Well, it's based on the old acrobat costumes from the circuses and so forth. So I am pretty much old school. I do like the original version, but that's not because my son said, you know, you were critical of what was it called, the Zack Snyder Superman,
Man of Steel.
And it was because, you know, and he said that's one of the reasons I didn't like it. I said, no, it has nothing to do with his trunks being gone. I don't care. I mean, if that's what they want to revamp the costume, go ahead. I mean, I saw designs where it was unrecognizable. It was like a black outfit, didn't have the S and all that. So we should be grateful they kept as much of it as they did. I mean, they could have gotten rid of the cape for all we know.
Too dark, that Superman, for you?
Well, I just don't think it's easy to apply that sort of dark, brooding Batman motif onto Superman, who was, you know, optimistic and full of hope and, you know, primary colors rather than the dark. I mean, listen, this is not an original take on this, but I did think it was like, instead of the joy of having X-ray vision, he's looking at people and seeing their internal organs like they're, you know, the Walking Dead, and everything is so terrible and grim. But look, why listen to me? I mean, I guess they're wildly successful, but, you know, they're constantly reinventing for a new young audience.
Black Pearl live action or animated, happening, not happening?
No, it's not happening. I mean, at the moment. I mean, the whole point was it's meant to be live action. The whole point was, I mean, it was a diversion to turn it into a comic book, because the whole idea was why there can't be a Batman in real life. In other words, a look at a guy who attempts to be a vigilante in a costume, and how it goes drastically wrong. It's closer to Fargo than it is, you know, somebody making a bad decision and the consequences of that than somebody who's, you know, meant to be a real hero. We put a lot of time and effort into it over the years and nurtured it. It came to a point where, you know, we had been turned down enough times where we said, you know, we had other projects that we had to attend to anyway. And maybe that window is closed. I mean, I'll keep an open mind, but I don't see going out and pitching it again. Although, who knows, with Netflix and all these other ways of delivering product, because I thought it was designed to be enhanced by a low budget rather than hurt by it. It's not an epic. It's about a guy who does what he does, and he's unbalanced, and he nearly gets killed in the process. So I wanted it to be very sort of the antithesis of a fantasy Hollywood film. I wanted it to have a complete lack of that Hollywood artifice and be as real as almost a docudrama. So we'll see what happens. But like I say, my plate is so full, who knows when I would be able to do that.
Season 2 of Pop Culture Quest?
They want me to do it. We're trying to figure out whether I can do it. But they want it to come back, and they want it to be longer. They want it to be like 22 minutes long now. So, but it's very preliminary. I mean, I'd love to get feedback to see how people react, because it's sort of hard to know, you know, we're working in it's hard to see the forest for the trees, you know, because they say, oh, well, it's had this many downloads and this many hits, and you go, wow, that sounds great, and then you realize, well, wait a minute, if this were a TV show, we'd be canceled with only 3 million or whatever it was. But again, it's a whole new world in terms of, because originally when we were pitching it to the Sci-Fi Channel, the History Channel, and all that. We didn't realize that, you know, there was a whole market for online material.
Annual appearances by the Trickster? Can we count on?
Well, so far, I've made an appearance in each season. They wanted to do another one this year, but John was doing a play, so they got postponed. And then they wanted me to reschedule, and then this thing came up that I have to go back and do in the UK. So it got pushed back again. I think they're going to try and fit it in this season. If not, it'll have to wait till next season.
This thing you had to do, man, you were fun. Mark, this has been an amazing experience here at Comic Book Central. Happy anniversaries all around, my friend.
Thank you.
Hope we get more of the Trickster on the Flash. Can't wait for the return of our favorite Jedi this winter, man. That's going to be fun. And hopefully beyond episode 9.
Very good, yeah. Like I say, it's been so satisfying for me to be able to revisit these characters I love, and, you know, the support of the fan world is, you know, it's beyond what I expected, and I think it's because they know I'm one of them. I'm not a poser. I'm a fan just like them. So
You are, and the pleasure is all ours. Thank you so much for joining me today on Comic Book Central.
All right, Joe. All the best.
Two takeaways I have from that conversation. One, Mark Hamill definitely would have crushed it with the Wookiee Life Day song back in 1978. Two, his DVR is apparently packed with comic book TV shows and movies. He's watching them all, folks. You could tell that. He is a fanboy. That is one of the things we love about him. And I can tell you from personal experience, he is the real deal. I got to hang out with him briefly at San Diego Comic-Con a while back. I think it was in 04, somewhere around there, I believe. He loves all this stuff. I'm telling you, if he could walk around and visit all the comic book dealers at a convention without being recognized, he would be in seventh heaven. And I know for a fact that he has glassware in use with cartoon characters on him. Yes, he does. Trust me on that one. Hey, if you want to see Mark geeking out over other fans' collectibles, get on over to Comic-Con HQ Online. Watch Mark Hamill's Pop Culture Quest. It is a cool series. You're going to love it. There's a free trial period for the streaming service, so you can check out a bunch of stuff on there. See if you like it. Sign up if you do. I'm sure you're going to like it. I'm going to put that link in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net, as well as a link to Mark's social media pages. You're going to have those there as well. So, man, galaxy-sized thanks to Mark Hamill for stopping by today. Star Wars The Last Jedi opens December 15th. Can't wait for that. I know we're all going to be there to see what Luke Skywalker's been up to all this time. I'm sure Mark's going to have a lot more to say in this film as well than he did the last one, so that's going to be fun. Kids, if you want to own Mark's return to the world of The Flash as the Trickster, here is your chance. I have season one of The Flash on Blu-ray, courtesy of those wonderful Warner Brothers folks, and it could be yours. If you haven't already, go like Comic Book Central on Facebook, facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. Don't forget the network. Follow the show on Twitter at comicbookctrl. If you're on the website, comicbookcentral.net, there's links to both of those pages right there at the top. On those social media pages, you will find a pinned post with a picture of The Flash Season 1 Blu-ray and a link to this episode of Comic Book Central. You share that pinned post on Facebook, or you retweet that pinned post on Twitter, or you do both because that would make you cooler than cool. You do that, your name goes into the Speed Force, and one of you listeners is going to come out of the Speed Force with that Blu-ray set. Simple as that. Always love it when you share the lair. This month, I might be sharing season one of The Flash with you. Get to it, Speedsters. Time is of the essence. I'm giving you till March 3rd to share or retweet that pin post. After that, I'm going to select a listener that does that. I will announce that name on an upcoming show. Don't forget, as I mentioned, past episodes of Comic Book Central, they can be found on the website, in the archive, iTunes. You get them all that way. Subscribe to the show. Leave a review if you please. Always appreciate that. Blueberry, Stitcher, Google Play. The lair is everywhere. Tell your friends. Tell your neighbors. Tell everyone down at the comic book store all about Comic Book Central. Share the lair. Always love it when you do that. And tell me what's on your mind, too. I want to hear from you. Joe@comicbookcentral.net. That's the email. Click the Signal Me tab. That's right there on the website as well. I can hear from you there. There's also a tab where you can click to record a voicemail message for the show. Tell me what you think. Tell me what you think about today's episode, your guest ideas, whatever you want to talk about. I want to hear from you. All right, all you space pirates and princesses, all you jokers and Harleys, you pranks and tricksters out there, that's all I got for you today. And you would think that flashback, flash forward February has come to a close here on Comic Book Central. No, but you would be wrong, Gorilla Grodd Breath, because in just a few short days, I'm going to be coming back at you with a bonus Flash-centric episode. That is right. Tuesday, February 28th, I will officially close out Flash Month with the director who has helmed some of the most iconic episodes of The Flash, including some of our favorites, The Flash of Two Worlds and Flashpoint. Yep, he was directing both of those. He also directed Flash crossovers on Arrow. He got Supergirl to channel some really dark emotions. And he just put the Archie gang through their paces on Riverdale. Super director Jesse Warren joins me on Tuesday for a Flash bonus episode. I know you're going to be joining us as well. Until then, keep on collecting all that pop culture goodness. Keep reading those comics. And thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 imported license. All of the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
Chewbacca! Chewbacca, we were so relieved to hear you were all right.
All of you are an important part of my life, pal. I'm glad I could be here.
This holiday is yours. But we all share with you the hope that this day brings us closer to freedom and to harmony and to peace. No matter how different we appear, we're all the same in our struggle against the powers of evil and darkness. I hope that this day will always be a day of joy in which we can reconfirm our dedication and our courage, and more than anything else, our love for one another. This is the promise of the Tree of Life.